Hydrogen is exciting. Hydrogen is exciting because it's one of the opportunities Australia has to continue the role that we play to the world. We export lots of minerals. We export lots of energy. Today it's in the form of coal and gas. And we're recognised by countries like Japan and Korea and a lot of our Asian neighbours as being a high-quality, reliable supplier. We take pride in that as a nation.
Good day, everyone. Welcome back to Cutting Carbon. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmeer, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Brian Gutnecht. Good day, Brian.
Jeff, as always, it's great to be here with you. Looking forward to a great discussion.
Brian's so right. This is season four of the podcast, and we've pivoted. We're now talking about global policy. Today, we're joined by Mark Collette. Mark is the Managing Director of Energy Australia, which is based in Melbourne, Australia. So today's episode is going to be about decarbonization policy in Australia. Mark's been with Energy Australia for over 18 years and had varying roles in corporate strategy and energy markets and sustainability. Mark, welcome to Cutting Carbon.
G'day, Jeff. G'day, Brian. It's wonderful to be here.
Mark, so let's dive right in. And for most of our listeners who are in the U.S. or in Europe, I want to help give them an introduction. Can you tell us a little bit more about Australia? Many of us will think about Australia is a country with abundant land, with the potential for significant amounts of wind and solar. So as we think about Australia, we think about energy policy, can you help our listeners understand a bit about the country and about the current energy mix today with these different technologies?
Australia is a pretty rare country in that we are a country that's also a continent. We're about the same size as continental US or about the same size as China. So it's big. There's lots of land, but not so many people. We've got about 25 million people. As you say, lots of land, lots of sun, and lots of just about every mineral you can name. So we're the world's biggest or second biggest exporter of coal and gas, old forms of energy. But looking at Australia, we have lots of coal, we have lots of gas, but for the future, more importantly, we've got lots of wind, we have lots of sun. The only energy technology that we're fuel constrained on is water. We're a continent that's not abounding in water in the same way as you get in some parts of Scandinavia. And when you look at all of that, it's probably no surprise that we started with the easiest forms of energy to produce. Our electricity system was based on the coal and gas technologies of the early 1900s. And even as recently as 2000, about 91% of our electricity came from coal and gas. That's rapidly falling. Today, it's about 54% coal, 20% gas, and 24% renewables. And the renewables have about tripled over the past 20 years. The growth of renewables has been astounding. Over 3 million households in our country today have solar. That's more than one in four households. It's the biggest penetration in the world. There's so much solar in our system that the most challenging part of our electricity system is now that solar peak. In some states, we're approaching the time where we'll have no net demand in the state, nowhere for the power to go at midday when it's solar peak. South Australia is now 55% renewable over the course of a year, and the instantaneous production proportions are much higher. So looking forward, we see that transition continuing, the coal to renewables, the fossil fuels to renewables, and it's all about what does that system of the future look like. And our job as Energy Australia is to stitch together the renewables which come with the weather with the rest of the system to make sure our customers have power when they need it.
So Mark, I want to kind of take what you've already told us about and kind of tie some themes in here. I know that the government of Australia has published what they're calling a long-term emissions reduction plan with the goal of being net zero by 2050. So can you kind of help us understand kind of what's going on there? It definitely seems like Australia is making inroads into the 2050 goal, but what are the policies that are happening already today? And what are the policies that are going to be needed to make this 2050 goal real?
It's worth just recapping on what Australia actually is. We are a federation, and the Federation of Australia was formed on the 1st of January 1901. And when that happened, the states ceded some powers to the new federal government, things like defence. Other powers, energy, remain state powers. In that context, the way Australia's energy systems developed was all state-based, and for a long time, we had little electricity islands in each state. So today, when we hear the federal government speak of a long-term emissions reduction plan, they cover some elements of the economy through some of their constitutional powers, but it's done with the states. And so, when we look at the long-term plan, a lot of the policy that brings together what happens in the individual states happens within the states. And the federal government's role in that context is to provide a national framework through which policy is delivered. The important element that the federal government has put together in the long-term emissions reduction plan is really a push towards driving down the cost of technologies which will enable emissions reduction. We do have the goal now for Australia. We've committed to net zero by 2050. And to get there, we can see as a nation that there are certain technologies that are particularly important to us. As a big country with lots of sun, solar is important. The federal government has set a target of $15 per megawatt hour, Australian dollar, $15 per megawatt hour solar. That's a pretty exciting place that we are looking to deliver as a nation. Equally, we have other technologies like hydrogen and 8-hour storage that are important to our decarbonisation future. So that roadmap sets out the activities the federal government will support, and each of the states have their role to play along the way to bring those technologies to life. But policy comes together to support those between actions that are done collectively by states and that federal government of ours.
Hey, Mark, if I could, I'm going to pull a little on what you said about how you kind of talked about the states almost operating as islands, separated grids. How interconnected is the power system? And can you maybe talk a little bit about the grid infrastructure? Because often we hear that, you know, particularly you talked about having built your system off of the traditional fossil generation, you think hub and spoke. And now with so many renewable resources, how is that? How do you see that system effect happening in Australia?
Even as recently as the 1980s and 1990s, we did operate largely as little islands of electricity systems. We do view ourselves as Australians, though, and from time to time we come together and say, right, it's time for national reform. It's time to share the bounties of Australia across state borders and do it together. And in the 1990s, there was a huge push to share the bounties of the electricity and energy systems across state borders. And the way that came to life was the creation of a national electricity market. Now, we did leave out a few states just because they were so far away. We called it a national electricity market, but it's just the eastern states. And the way it came to life was interconnection. So there was interconnectors built between each of the states, which all of a sudden for the first time allowed a lot of the states to share power. And so Victoria, historically one of the states where we're based, had a big brown coal electricity production system, which was very cheap. Without the cost of carbon applied to brown coal, it is very cheap. And in the early 2000s and late 1990s, the Victorian brown coal provided an economic stimulus to other states in the form of cheap power. That's how it came to life. In the scheme of things, being a continental country, our power grids are long and skinny. The way they've tended to be built is to connect big sources of supply, like our Hunter Valley or Latrobe Valley, with big sources of demand, like Melbourne and Sydney. And the rest of the network has been pretty long and skinny. Looking forward, we won't have those super supply hubs in the same form, because instead of a few big fossil power stations, we expect to have hundreds of solar and wind technologies connected all over the grid. So the development of the grid for us is a huge national endeavour. And the way we're taking it forward as a country is the development of renewable energy zones, where we will be building transmission hubs which allow the connection of large volumes of renewable projects in regions which historically haven't been big electricity producers. And by connecting all of those sources of supply, we'll build a new grid to power a new form of system for our people.
Mark, that's really interesting. So I want to take kind of what you described here about how Australia energy policy has come to be, but think about, right, as you said, the individual states are creating their own energy policy destiny. But is there some kind of overarching federal policy that, if you will, smooths out the rough edges, so to speak, between the states? So maybe you could help us understand, are there major differences in the energy policy between, let's say, Victoria and New South Wales or the Northern Territories? Or are all the states' energy policies sort of just all coalescing together?
On the electricity side, there's certain commonalities across all of the states, and they won't surprise any of our listeners today. States care about reliability. They want to make sure the power system is secure and reliable and available to all customers when they flick on the light switch. States care about decarbonizing, and individual states have different targets. So, for example, New South Wales has committed to a 50% reduction on carbon emissions relative to 2005 levels by 2030. Victoria's got a slightly different target. It's between 45 to 50% reduction. But the direction of travel for all of the states is similar. It's just the absolute magnitudes change a little bit. We have had a history of our states watching each other and looking at the policies one state puts in place and considering whether they're appropriate for other states. And often the policies are pretty similar in terms of how they do come to life. Things like those renewable energy zones, the transmission connection zones for larger volumes of renewables, they are interpreted and come to life in slightly different ways, but they're all variations on a theme. The opportunity has always been for a national approach, and the advantage of a national approach is that if the rules are the same across each of the states, it's easier for investors to understand how the system works and to develop new projects at a lower cost. And that's where, when the governments do come together and standardise policies and do things like create the national electricity market, as they did in the 1990s, that's the big economic opportunity.
Great. So, Mark, I want to pivot a little bit. The Council of Australian Governments put out a report in 2019 basically calling for hydrogen to be Australia's next big energy export, that is, kind of replacing export of coal with export of hydrogen. What can you share about kind of that aspirational goal for Australia? What does it mean for Australia to become the hydrogen supplier to, you know, that part of the world, to Asia?
Hydrogen is exciting. Hydrogen is exciting because it's one of the opportunities Australia has to continue the role that we play to the world. We export lots of minerals. We export lots of energy. Today it's in the form of coal and gas, and we're recognised by countries like Japan and Korea and a lot of our Asian neighbours as being a high-quality, reliable supplier. We take pride in that as a nation. Hydrogen gives us the opportunity to take advantage of the natural bounty we have of renewables in the form of solar and wind and use those technologies to develop a new zero carbon form of energy that we can supply to our Asian neighbours. So that's a pretty exciting opportunity for the country, and it's a natural extension of things that we're good at, which is why it's got so much of the country so excited.
Mark, so that's really great, but what would you say are the challenges as you think about this, and what really needs to happen from a policy perspective to make this happen, to make this possible?
The vision is super exciting. That's absolutely true. And then the question is, how do I realize that vision? How do we as a nation get there? And the approach to date by the various federal and state governments has been pretty similar because they share that vision, that sense of excitement. And so the approach to date has been to create what we call hydrogen hubs. And at the moment, the federal and state governments are talking and working together on where are the best places for those hubs. So, for example, we own the Tullawarra Power Station, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little later. And we're excited about the hydrogen opportunity for that power station. And the New South Wales government is committed to creating an Illawarra hub. And within that hub, our Tullawarra Power Station will be an important source of demand. And the idea of a hub is that we then connect different sources of supply and demand so that we get to industrial scale to grow a hydrogen industry. That's the basic approach that's underway. Now, in order to bring that to life, we do see the federal government, for example, in their hydrogen strategy, they're putting funding on the table to jointly fund projects to add to, for example, supply within a hub. And the idea is that there's enough of government push to kickstart an industry within the hubs that at some point will hit critical mass and will just take off and launch into Asia as a big supplier of hydrogen.
You're listening to Cutting Carbon. If you're interested in learning more about today's topic, please check out our show notes. And if you like what you hear, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. All right, let's go back to the conversation. Mark, that's really great. Now, I do want to talk about the Tallawarra project, but before I get there, I do want to talk about an op-ed piece that you wrote, and I believe was published in the Australian Financial Review. And I want to pull two specific quotes and ask you some questions on those. So the first quote, you said that financing net zero does not mean only financing net zero emission activities. Can you help our listeners understand kind of what you meant and why that's such an important statement?
Absolutely. Today, we have an electricity system which is still about 74% fossil fuel. Net zero means we get that system to net zero by 2050, but it also means we're on a trajectory. It doesn't mean that we can just turn all those fossil fuels off today and be there tomorrow. In fact, we don't have anything to replace the fossil fuels with should we turn them off immediately. So that statement about financing is ultimately reflecting that we are part of an energy transition. Today, for example, we own the Mount Piper power station, a coal-fired power station in New South Wales. That power station runs on coal. That coal is essential to ensure that the system remains secure and reliable during times of high demand, be it summer or winter, or times when there are outages of other generators on the system. We buy coal. If our coal suppliers today are unable to access finance to continue coal mining operations, that means that power station is not there to provide the security and the reliability the system needs today. So absolutely, Mount Piper will not produce coal in 2050. We've already committed to be out by at least 2040, but we acknowledge that it has an essential role today. So our concern is to ensure that we meet the needs of today and then transition as quickly as we can. But starving the needs of today, we think will be counterproductive in the sense that it will create disruption to our customers. And success comes from bringing our customers along the ride of the energy transition.
Mark, so I was going to ask you a second question, but you've kind of partially answered it already. I was going to pull a second quote from your op-ed where you talked about the necessity of existing generation and energy storage, but that you have to build energy storage because today there's really nothing to replace coal and gas. In the quote, you said that having zero carbon generation or the necessary energy storage to replace that because there's nothing there that you can use to readily replace coal and gas if you turn it off. You have to build that next piece. You've got to build that energy storage. And I guess that goes to your comment on the energy transition. Again, that if you turned off coal and gas today, as much as we want wind, as much as we want solar, as much as we want all these renewables, it's just not there yet.
Well, that's right, Jeff. And even if we do a thought experiment and we say, well, let's say we had all the wind and solar we needed to produce the entire electricity supply we would want over the course of a year for Australia. We can imagine that. And we can imagine having solar on rooftops and solar farms and wind farms. But we also know they're variable. And we know that solar produces 60% less energy in winter than it does in summer. And we know from past observations that we get things like wind droughts, periods of a week or more where there's no wind. So even if we had that system today where we could produce enough energy over the course of a year, in system normal, that's fine. We can do everything we need to. But during a wind drought, we don't have anything to back up the system without coal and gas today. If we had massive volumes of batteries already installed, We could use those to get through day-to-day fluctuations, but the advantage of coal and gas today in just supporting the system is that they provide an incredible buffer. So, for example, gas storage facilities often store gas all summer to use all winter. Coal stockpiles provide 6 weeks backup, often to continued operation of a power station. Batteries often provide 1 to 8 hours of storage. 6 weeks versus 1 day, pretty stark view on the amount of supply backup we have in the existing system today. So that's what I want for our customers and for Australians. I want to make sure we have enough backup so that our system works through those wind droughts and other periods. And at the moment, it's not there. So that's why we want to make sure we do the energy transition in a really considered way so that we end up with some great outcomes.
So that's great, Mark. You need that backbone to be there for those periods, those droughts, as you described them. But obviously, you'd like to decarbonize those assets as well, which may be a good transition to talk a little about Tallawarra. So GE's excited to be providing Energy Australia with a 9F gas turbine for operation in 2024, and its ability to burn hydrogen was a part of the decision process. Tell us a little bit about it.
Tallawarra B, we're very excited about Tallawarra B. It's around 350 megawatts. It's an open cycle gas turbine, and it will be ready to go in just a few years' time, by 2024. Now, we have committed from the get-go that we will look to buy 5% of the annual output in hydrogen. That's 200,000 kilograms of hydrogen per year. And we're looking forward to burning hydrogen as part of the fuel mix to create power. That will be the first of its kind for Australia. That's a start. As I said earlier, it's a source of demand for the Illawarra Hydrogen Hub. It gives a market signal to many who are looking at hydrogen as a production play. Beyond that, though, we are committed to looking at where we take it. 5% is the start. I know, having spoken to a number of folks at GE, that there's some folks in GE who think, hey, we might be able to do 100% hydrogen with this turbine and with other turbines. Imagine how exciting that is. If we can get something like Tallawarra B to 100% hydrogen, 100% zero carbon, in a way that backs up a renewable system, that's a pretty exciting future. That's something that will give reliable and secure power for our customers, and that's a vision I think we share.
Yeah, Mark, that is very exciting. And I just want to kind of pull on that thread a little bit. As Brian said, we want to focus on the reliability of the grid. And the amazing thing about hydrogen is that once you've made the hydrogen, and whether it's blue hydrogen from fossil fuel or green hydrogen from electrolysis, once you have made the hydrogen, you can store the hydrogen. And that you've stored the hydrogen, if you happen to have a situation where it's not very windy for an extended period of time, or you've got, you know, very cloudy days for an extended period of time, you've got this energy storage in the form of hydrogen. And now you can just kind of open up the valve on that facility and put the hydrogen to the pipeline and bring it to your gas turbine or gas turbines. And now you've got megawatts of power that are available to back up the grid, to back up your renewables, providing that grid reliability.
Absolutely, Jeff. That's probably the most exciting thing about hydrogen. We see a range of storage technologies being suited to our grid. And so, for example, starting with our customers, we have some really exciting offerings where we combine solar and battery for a home or business with a backup supply from the grid. Now, the batteries that we put in someone's home might have 1 or 2 hours of storage, but that's enough to get through day to day, particularly in summer when you're getting the solar to recharge the battery within the day. We also have hydro projects that we are working on. Things like the Kidston pump storage that we are the off-taker for in Queensland, 250 megawatts, 8 hours storage. We're also developing Lake Lyell in New South Wales near a Mount Piper power station. Again, 8 hours of storage, a bit over 300 megawatts. 8 hours of storage is a good week-to-week buffer. It gets you through some of those cloudy and still days in winter. But more than that, we know we've got to be able to get through a wind drought and just the vagaries of the energy market. Unexpected stuff happens that takes some plants offline for weeks at a time. Today, it's disruptions to thermal power stations. It might be something happens, a storm that takes down transmission lines in the future. There's always been shocks to the system. So hydrogen is super exciting because it does give the opportunity to really increase the buffer for the system. I saw The Economist magazine talked about electricity suppliers of the future, perhaps having something like a strategic energy reserve that you have over there in the US for oil. It might be that hydrogen is a big part of that strategic electricity reserve. It's the backup for the system for those times when it's not system normal. There's not a lot of technologies that fit in that bucket and can do it zero carbon, and that's what makes hydrogen one of the most exciting technologies we're looking at.
Exciting. Mark, clearly Australia is a leader in the energy transition here. Exciting what you've shared with us so far. Look forward for us. Where do you see it going from here? And maybe particularly when you think about maybe some of the policy needs to continue advancing Australia's ambitions, what needs to happen there and what are you excited about?
Brian, it's been an amazing roller coaster ride watching Australia decarbonize. And fair to say, initially, it was driven by a lot of policy initiatives, things like the renewable energy target, which ultimately kickstarted the renewable energy industry at a large scale. The amazing thing of the past few years is we're seeing customer demand for decarbonisation. We're seeing a lot of corporate customers, a lot of business customers, but more than that, a lot of households reach out and say, right, how do I decarbonise and what can I commit to with my purchasing choices to support the energy system of the future? That dynamic is much bigger than we saw at times in the last decades. And it's now as big as policy. It's as big as policy because when people choose of their own volition to pick their own technologies and to support their own form of the energy system, policy doesn't have as big a role to play. Now, not everyone's doing that, so policy still has a role to play. But interestingly, it's probably almost getting to the point where policy will be the partner rather than the driver of decarbonisation because of the way customers are approaching this. Now, the nature of the system is changing, so undoubtedly policy will have to consider how we evolve the electricity market. So, for example, one of the big policy changes that is coming is to consider how does this system work when we get very high levels of renewables. With the high fossil penetration, some of the system security services, things like inertia, things like frequency control, they just automatically came because that was the nature of the way the system worked. In the absence of those types of generation, we'll create new markets. And we had a review that completed in 2017 that came up with a series of recommendations of things that we needed to evolve our market to deal with. And the Energy Security Board, which was a vehicle of policy created to work on all those recommendations, has put forward a whole lot of structural changes which will adapt the way our market works in order to make it work with very high levels of renewables. But it's a combination of the two, customer choices backed up by policy that keeps our system secure and reliable and ever decarbonising, that'll really deliver that net zero ambition.
Mark, this has been really great. I learned a ton today. We think about Australia, energy policy, how Australia is leading the way on the energy transition. As I said, I learned a lot. I think our listeners are going to learn a lot. So thank you so very much.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Brian. Wonderful to be here.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you all enjoyed the podcast. If you're listening to us for the first time, consider subscribing. You can subscribe to us on any of your favorite podcast platforms. If you happen to have a question about this episode, question about a previous episode, or maybe a suggestion for a future episode, drop us a line. You can reach us at cutting.carbon@ge.com. On behalf of the entire podcast team, again, thank you for listening. This is Cutting Carbon. Thanks for listening. If you want more information about today's episode, check out the resources available in our show notes. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmeier, and this is Cutting Carbon.